This is The Takeaway for Thursday, July 27th, 2017.
This is a great day for American workers and manufacturing, and for everyone who believes in the concept and the label Made in the USA.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. Taiwanese electronic giant Foxconn announced yesterday new plans to build a factory in Wisconsin. It's a move the company says could bring 3,000 jobs and up to $10 billion in total investment. Now, you just heard there, President Trump hosted Foxconn Chairman Terry Guo at the White House yesterday, where he took credit for the deal and for locating it in the swing state of Wisconsin.
Chairman Guo put his faith and confidence in the future of the American economy. In other words, if I didn't get elected, he definitely would not be spending $10 billion.
It's the president there from the White House yesterday. But reviving U.S. manufacturing was a big part of President Trump's 2016 campaign. Foxconn says the Wisconsin deal is the first of many investments in the U.S., but the details of the project remain unclear. In fact, a 2013 Foxconn plan to bring a high-tech factory to Pennsylvania and almost 500 jobs along with it never panned out. Here with more on the Foxconn deal and what the move means for U.S. trade policy and for the politics of U.S. manufacturing is Heather Long. She's with The Washington Post. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
What exactly does Foxconn do, and how important is this new announcement of a factory in Wisconsin?
It's really important in Wisconsin. I was actually there on the ground in Paul Ryan's district in May because I was covering the fact that General Electric was taking just 350 good manufacturing jobs and moving them to Canada. So that area of Wisconsin really needed a win on manufacturing jobs. And boy, did they seem to deliver with this Foxconn to deliver 3,000 jobs. If you actually listen to the press conference yesterday, a couple of them, including the governor of Wisconsin, Governor Walker, mentioned that it may be as many as 13,000. Now, there's a lot of skepticism if that will pan out. But that looks very good in a state which has lost about a third of its manufacturing jobs since 2000.
And right into the district of House Speaker Paul Ryan, and the politics of that shouldn't be too complicated to understand. Let's nail down what Foxconn does, though. What's their real business?
Well, their real business is to make equipment, to make electronics equipment. They work with pretty much everyone, all the household names we all buy from, whether it's Apple or whether it's Google or Amazon. In this case, they are going to make flat screens. So that is an industry that many people thought would never come back to the United States, certainly not in a big way. So that's, in terms of manufacturing policy, what a lot of people are playing up as a big win here, to see that kind of manufacturing come back to the United States.
It certainly is a win for the people who are going to get those jobs. There's no question about it. Let's talk about the larger picture, though. Deals like this one that the president touted along with the chairman of Foxconn rarely get done on their own, even if the White House trumpets only one part of it. What's the bigger picture here between U.S. officials and Foxconn, or between the Trump administration and Taiwan?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to look at. Number one, just from the big picture, so far this year, America has added 836,000 jobs. So 3,000 jobs is a good number. As you say, it matters to those people who are going to get those jobs. But it's really a drop in the bucket in the big context of job creation and where the jobs are coming in the United States. I think it's also interesting, as you mentioned, it's not just the White House who had a role here, but the state of Wisconsin. The governor yesterday mentioned that the state will be offering this company $3 billion in state incentives. You may remember all the outrage when there was the Carrier deal and the state of Indiana was offering only $7 million to that company. So we've gone from offering millions to try to keep jobs, manufacturing jobs in the U.S., to offering billions potentially from the state of Wisconsin. So that it's not like the Foxconn is doing this out of the goodness of their heart. They're definitely right. Getting a lot of money to come and do this in Wisconsin. On the bigger picture, there's this ongoing debate with the United States and China over trade policy. They keep threatening each other to do retaliatory measures over trade and put up barriers. So again, very fascinating that this is a Taiwanese company that the administration is really reaching their hand out to, and has actually had press conferences with him three times now since Trump was elected.
So the added benefit, look, lots of benefits here. You get the jobs. You get to make Paul Ryan look really good and make him happy. He's the Speaker of the House. And you get to take a swipe at China, mainland China, in the balance. It seems like a pretty good deal overall politically. What about broader U.S. trade policy here? You mentioned the carrier deal. President Trump touted it during the transition, that he was making a deal to prevent carrier from exporting jobs to Mexico. Now, most of those jobs have left or are leaving anyway. Foxconn seems to be a little more substantial, Heather. But are individual deals like this, do they represent a viable and coherent U.S. trade policy? Are we going to get beyond touting individual deals with individual companies and hear a broader strategy?
Exactly. You just hit the nail on the head. Most people would argue, no, this is not a broader policy. They keep waiting. Last week was Made in America Week, so obviously the administration keeps trying to verbally talk up American manufacturing as they have since Trump started his campaign. But there's yet to be any major action along these lines. So when I go and talk to these workers, for instance, when I was in Wisconsin in May, a lot of these workers, and many of whom voted for Trump, who were going to lose their jobs at the GE factory there in Paul Ryan and Jim Sensenbrenner's district, they were saying to me, where's the action on trade? Why hasn't there been that tariff? Why hasn't there been bigger action on NAFTA? So a member of Trump said he was just going to rip up NAFTA on the campaign trail. Now the tone that we're hearing from the administration, they are engaging in a renegotiation. Their initial document earlier this month that came out, sounded quite tame. You know, it sounded more like, okay, we're going to, instead of Trump the bulldozer in and rip it up, we're going to more try to do some quieter, tamer tweaks to the document.
We should also add, before we let you go, Heather Long, it is a nice thing maybe for two Republicans, Paul Ryan and Donald Trump, who disagree so vehemently on trade, to be able to share a stage and deliver a win to people in Janesville or in Paul Ryan's district. I mean, Paul Ryan is a free trader. Donald Trump just pulled us out of TPP.
Mm-hmm. It was also interesting that Steve Wynn was there and Trump acknowledged him. Steve Wynn, who runs the Wynn Casino in Las Vegas and has been a major donor to the GOP. So again, another political win there with him.
And also works in an important swing state, Nevada, which Donald Trump desperately would want to win if he ran for re-election. Heather Long with The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. President Trump's string of tweets yesterday barring transgender people from serving in the U.S. military unleashed a furious response from the LGBT community and from a lot of others. But it's also caused confusion, as the White House and the Pentagon have been unable to say exactly whom the policy affects or even how it will work. The president, though, explained his decision in part, pointing to what he called the burden and tremendous medical costs transgender military personnel would create. Gender transition surgeries are not typically covered by the military, although the Obama administration had laid the groundwork for it. Both a RAND analysis and a study in the New England Journal of Medicine estimated that the annual costs could range from $2.4 million to $8 million. And as for that tremendous medical cost, as it was widely pointed out on social media yesterday, that's about one-tenth of the $84 million the military spends every year on Viagra and other medications for erectile dysfunction. Dr. Jennifer Conti is an OBGYN physician and clinical assistant professor in obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford University. She works with transgender veterans through Stanford. It's nice to have you back on the show, Dr. Conti.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
President Trump, as I said, cited those exorbitant costs that transgender people would bring to the military as part of his reasons for his ban yesterday. What was your reaction?
My immediate reaction was that this is fake news. This is what the fake news he's been talking about. The military doesn't even cover transgender transition treatment or confirmation surgery, so this makes no sense at all.
What about veterans after they get out of the military?
It's a little bit different. You know, I'm not quite sure of the details about how the military takes care of the veterans once they leave the military, but you know, what I can say is that using tweets to suggest that the cost of transgender healthcare is justification for discrimination is not. It's not justification for discrimination.
Well, let's talk about those costs more broadly and put them into some context. You're a surgeon. You've got lots of colleagues who deal with other areas of medicine, internal medicine, primary care. How do the costs of gender reassignment and other health issues that transgender people confront stack up to, say, the cost of alcohol abuse or cigarette smoking in the population that you see?
Well, I think the numbers that you cited earlier are correct. You know, we have good data that show that when you look at the cost of caring for transgender individuals, whether they're veterans or not, it's really a negligible cost compared to the medical conditions that truly affect, you know, the majority of Americans: alcoholism, you know, diabetes care, hypertension, as you mentioned, treatment of erectile dysfunction. So it's negligible.
So just a small cost. And it sounds like that justification, Dr. Conti, really, well, it sounds like it kind of made you mad a little bit.
Oh, no, I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, Trump is pandering basically to his base, and he's doing it at the expense of transgender individuals. You know, I can tell you that I provide gender confirmation surgery, and I care for transgender people, including veterans. And the relief that they feel afterwards is indescribable. You know, I can think of one man in particular who woke up after surgery and he was crying. He was saying that for years, decades of his life, he's been trying to feel like he's in the correct body. And it wasn't until now that he finally feels like a human.
So talk about that outcome in that case, and I'm sure you have many, many others like it, in terms of medical necessity. A lot of people would point to gender confirmation or gender reassignment, say it's fine if somebody wants to do that. It's just not medically necessary. It's not something that the government, much less the military, should be covering or condoning.
Right. So I disagree. I think that there's enormous medical and psychological consequences that stem from being forced to live in the wrong body. And it's too simple, and you can't just say this is something that's elective, especially if you haven't been personally forced to do that, to walk through those, you know, the steps of these people and feel like you're living in the wrong body. It's not true.
So when you evaluate a patient like that, a transgender person who's seeking gender confirmation, and you evaluate them along with all the other doctors on your team and in your hospitals, can you put it in context of the other things the other doctors would be looking at, say, I don't know, their heart disease, their blood pressure, their overall mental health? How does it fit into the patient's overall health picture?
And that's a hard question to answer. It's compounded, right? So if you have spent your whole life feeling like you're in the wrong body, of course, that's going to have effects on your health, whether it's, you know, medical conditions like maybe high blood pressure, anxiety, depression, you know, psychological effects. I don't think that you can piece point and pull that out and really compare it. And I think that's because this is, you know, this is a portion of healthcare just like any other medical condition.
And before we let you go, Dr. Jennifer Conti, what did you hear around the hospital? Did you talk to any of your patients after the president's announcement yesterday and get their reaction?
Yeah, I spoke with a transgender man yesterday. I asked him, you know, did you hear what Trump said? What are you thinking about this? And he got angry. He said, there's never been a president until now who has affected my life so much. And he was furious.
Dr. Jennifer Conti, OBGYN physician and clinical assistant professor at Stanford, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much.
Well, we've been asking you, do you support President Trump's ban on transgender service members? We put that question out to you on Twitter, and nearly 1,000 of you have already voted in our poll. It's pretty close, but we still want to hear from you. Head to Twitter and take our poll today and follow us at The Takeaway.
My name is Mike. I'm calling from Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. These assumptions that somebody's going to get kicked out of the military after serving 18 years is ludicrous. As long as the person doesn't want to have the military pay for this operation and procedures, then I feel confident that there won't be any problem for anyone. So It seems like a perfectly reasonable policy.
My name is Caroline Farr. I'm calling from Wilmington, Delaware. I listen to lots and lots of people call in horrified by the transgender issue, which is bad, but it means that all those people aren't calling in about healthcare and collusion.
Your calls on President Trump's decision to ban transgender people from the military. You can ask me anything on Twitter. I try to read those tweets. I always do my best to respond back to you personally. I'm at Todd Zwillick.
The Takeaway is supported by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at arkansasedc.com.
Summer is tick season in America, and anytime it gets warmer, the chance of tick-borne illnesses like Lyme disease goes up. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention notes that approximately 30,000 cases of Lyme disease are reported every year, but they also caution that those cases are vastly underreported. And as temperatures fluctuate across the country, different species of ticks are migrating into new territory, and that means that people are at risk of contacting those ticks and diseases that they may never have known about. Dr. Sam Telford is an epidemiologist and professor of infectious diseases and global health at the Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University. And he says that even if you haven't heard of them, these pathogens are nothing new.
Well, they're emerging. They're being increasingly recognized, but they're all old. They've all been under our nose for the past 30 years. They're not new. And Lyme disease, the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, is more efficiently transmitted and amplifies locally a lot easier than the other four infections. But as the tick populations become more dense, those other infections are starting to catch up in terms of the intensity of transmission. And so it's not that these are new, but the conditions that we've made by letting the forest grow back and letting the deer run amok mean that there are more ticks, and more ticks means that these pathogens can cycle themselves more efficiently.
What kinds of diseases are we talking about?
Well, we've long known human babesiosis, a malaria-like infection, was reported before Lyme disease was in 1974. It was reported in 1969 from Nantucket. So there's babesiosis, there's human anaplasmosis, or also known as granulocytic ehrlichiosis. There's Borrelia miyamotoi disease, which is a relative of Lyme disease. And then there's deer tick virus, or what people are calling Powassan virus.
Is tick control an option, actually getting into the environment and either killing or discouraging ticks from breeding?
Yes, there are many options that homeowners can take, that communities can take, that larger areas can take to try to reduce the burden of tick-borne infections. And I've been amazed over 30 years that I have yet to get a community to act with resolution, with commitment to do so.
All right, so if you know how to kill ticks and people won't do it, what can they do?
At the very least, they can protect themselves personally. That is, they can use repellents, they can do tick checks, they can take a shower every night. Everybody should be aware of any unexplained fever and go seek healthcare attention immediately. But I make the point that we see 80 to 90% of all Lyme disease cases reported during the months of June, July, and August. At that time, the ticks that are around the teenager or nymphal stage of the deer tick, only 10 to 30% of them are carrying the bacteria that cause Lyme disease. When you start in the fall, in October and November, when the adult deer tick is around, 50 to 70% of those ticks are infected by the agent of Lyme disease. Yet we see very few cases during the fall. And it's not because the adult tick is not able to transmit. It's because people are dressed very differently during the cold weather, and ticks have a harder time getting up underneath the clothing. Also, the adult tick is bigger, and people find them and remove them before the tick has had a chance to transmit. Whereas the nymphal tick, you never even know it's there. You won't even see it.
One is always tempted in situations like this to attribute flourishing insects to climate change, but you're saying that's not necessarily the case here.
It's not necessarily the case for the deer tick. It may be the case for the Lone Star tick, which is invading the New England states from farther south.
But deer ticks prefer a cooler climate. And in fact, if the projected climate change predictions come out, as suggested, our neighbors to the north in Canada will receive our problems, and we will become like our neighbors to the south, where there's less Lyme disease.
Dr. Sam Telford of Tufts University, thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
We go to Venezuela now, where the street protests and rallies of the last several months have now turned into a 48-hour nationwide strike. The strike is now on its second day. Stores are closed all across the country. Workers have been told to stay home, and public transportation is at a near standstill. All of this action is in mass protest against an election Sunday for a new constituent assembly. It's part of President Nicolas Maduro's plan to make the assembly a new governing body for his beleaguered country and to eventually draft a new constitution. The opposition in Venezuela believes this is all an attempt to consolidate Maduro's power and even to extend his presidency. On Wednesday, the Trump administration slapped new sanctions on several officials and influential people in Venezuela to try to discourage these moves by Maduro. But can it work? Does the U.S. have the influence it once had in Venezuela? Ambassador Patrick Duddy served as U.S. ambassador to Venezuela from 2007 to 2008 and then again from 2009 to 2010 under the Bush administration and the Obama administration. He's now director of the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies at Duke University. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What is your assessment of this constituent assembly that Maduro appears to be forcing into existence here? We know its stated function is to draft a new constitution eventually. What's its real function from your point of view?
I think it's designed to give the administration of Nicolas Maduro a tool for avoiding a free, fair national election. The last time they held elections for the legislature, the United Opposition took two-thirds of the seats in the National Assembly. All of the local polling says very, very clearly that if the administration of Maduro goes to holds a national election, they're going to be very solidly trounced.
So Maduro doesn't want to endure that kind of embarrassment. So that seems, well, fairly obvious. Meanwhile, I mentioned these new sanctions from the United States, kind of these 11th hour sanctions on Maduro friends and allies in Venezuela. Does the U.S. have a chance at a constructive role here? I mean, part of the entire storyline of the legitimacy of Hugo Chavez and then Nicolas Maduro is to get U.S. influence out. We're now slapping new sanctions on. Do we have any opportunity for a constructive role that can tip things a different direction here?
Well, I think it's very important to understand that for all of the hostility directed at the United States by the administrations of Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, the United States remains Venezuela's largest market for their only significant export, which is, of course, oil. At the same time, there has historically been a close connection between the peoples of the United States and Venezuela. The other point I would make is that the United States is, in many respects, not acting alone. As recently as just a couple of days ago, 13 countries from around the region all called on the government of Maduro to cancel the Constituent Assembly, as I think all of them see this as a stratagem to avoid having to contend with the clear disappointment of the Venezuelan people with how the Chavistas, or as they're sometimes called, Bolivarians, have mismanaged the country and its economy.
Well, at the same time, Maduro seems to be forging ahead despite these entreaties that you mentioned, Ambassador. If he goes through with the formation of the assembly after Sunday, what do you think happens next?
Well, the administration has threatened economic sanctions. To date, the administration has sanctioned only individuals plausibly accused of undermining democracy, being complicit in egregious violations of human rights or substantial acts of corruption. But the sanctions have not been on the national economy. The announcement from the White House the other day suggested that broader, possibly sectoral sanctions are now on the table if they go through with the Constituent Assembly. And there are no details on what that might involve, but the economy in Venezuela is in a shambles. And it is, I think, anticipated that economic sanctions would make life very substantially more difficult for the government of Venezuela.
Ambassador Patrick Duddy, U.S. Ambassador to Venezuela from 2007 until 2010. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Well, if oil is a natural resource that's helped determine the fate of Venezuela, mineral wealth in Afghanistan is the resource that could determine not only Afghanistan's fate, but the United States' protracted role in that country. A report in the New York Times this week pointed to new interest from the Trump administration in developing Afghanistan's estimated $1 trillion in mineral reserves. Part of the thinking here? It could justify continued American investment in the country after 16 years of war. But here's a key question. Can Afghanistan's vast mineral wealth be developed in a way that doesn't just lead to more conflict? Should Afghans be worried when they hear the American president say things like this about America's other long war in Iraq?
We should have kept the oil when we got out.
I've always said, shouldn't be there, but if we're going to get out, take the oil.
We should have taken the oil.
Stephen Carter is Afghanistan campaign leader at Global Witness. He studies mining and corruption in Afghanistan, and he says the country's resources are attractive.
Afghanistan has an embarrassment of riches when it comes to extractive resources. Everything from gold and copper to lapis lazuli, precious stones, iron ore, lithium. And lithium is being particularly talked about at the moment as an area that has great potential. The problem with the estimate of $1 trillion is, first of all, the difficulties of getting the stuff out of the ground, and more importantly, the difficulties of governance, because the goal in Afghanistan is not to dig minerals out of the ground. The goal is to produce something that actually creates a benefit for the people of Afghanistan, that helps support the Afghan budget and provides a plausible path to developing the Afghan economy as a whole.
Right. I mean, this is the major challenge. I mean, it's one thing to be interested in $1 trillion in minerals. In a way, if it were easy or convenient to get at them, not only physically, but also in terms of the political context in Afghanistan, it seems like those deals would have been done a long time ago.
Well, there have been some attempts to make deals, particularly for the more accessible minerals. The issue is partly about the infrastructure. There's a need for railways, there's a need for roads, electricity, and to help develop the sector. But the biggest challenge is governance. And that's really the concern we have with the focus of the administration on extractives, that there is a sense that this is a quick win.
So, Stephen, let's talk a little bit about what we know about the Trump administration's intentions here. The president reportedly has been reluctant to follow his generals and authorize an escalation and 4,000 more troops in Afghanistan. Some have described this plan or this ability to extract resources from Afghanistan as a way to keep the president interested in the project. Do you have a sense of whether that's the case and what the plan is here, given all of the difficulties in investment and governance that you're talking about?
The administration is looking for a new strategy in Afghanistan, and that's perhaps part of what is going on here, that after 16 years, the need for something new is pressing, and from what we hear from public reports, there is a dissatisfaction in the White House with the idea of just continuing on the current path.
Stephen, history must have plenty of lessons about what happens if a foreign power tries to quickly and easily extract resources from Afghanistan without the types of investments that you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, the danger that the Afghan people will perceive this as a looting of their resources is very acute. And that will be a key propaganda point for the Taliban, which I am sure that they would exploit to the hilt. The danger is that there would be a immediate rise in conflict, and you'd attract insurgent groups to those areas. You'd attract armed groups who would be wanting to get a piece of the action. At that stage, either there is going to be a lot of expenditure needed to secure that area and a lot of violence, which can potentially affect the, you know, the economics of the whole project, or you have a situation where the Taliban get paid off in order to allow mining to take place. That would in effect mean that American companies were helping to fund the insurgency or illegal armed groups.
You know, Stephen, one of the major factors that's prevented American corporations from clamoring into Afghanistan is corruption. As you know, Afghanistan is ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world. Corporations who do want to do business there feel like they have to discount 20, 25, 30% off the top for corruptions and bribes, because that's how business gets done in Afghanistan. How big of a factor is that? And do you think the Trump administration, even in these early musings, is thinking that through?
The issue of corruption in Afghanistan is absolutely key. It's key not just for developing the economy and developing sectors like the extractive sector. It's key to the stability of the country. It's one of the absolutely core drivers of the insurgency. And it is a factor which deeply undermines the strength and legitimacy of the government.
So, Stephen Carter, it's clear that real development of Afghanistan's mining resources and real investment could be an enormous benefit to the country and an enormous promoter of stability, but only if it's done in an extremely intentional way, only if it's done in the right way. What is that right way? How is it done?
There's no silver bullet, but there are things that can really move the dial. For example, with the mining law, we're talking about basic transparency measures. And perhaps most importantly, having a single account for production payment data so that you can make public in a very automatic way the revenues that are being provided by these mines and how much they're producing.
Well, Stephen Carter, before we let you go, you know, President Trump was fond during the campaign of telling crowds that the big mistake the United States made in Iraq was that we should have just taken the oil. Does that worry you?
That worries me enormously, yes. If the objective of the administration is to develop the Afghan mining sector, we would absolutely support that. But on the condition that there's a crystal clear understanding that the only way to do that is to first put in place these measures. And the opportunity is there. There are actually things that can be done. That's the other part of the message. But if that is not the case, if there's going to be an idea that this is some shortcut, then I think the result is only going to be further damage to the Afghan people and further damage to American interests in the country.
Stephen Carter is Afghanistan campaign leader at Global Witness. Stephen Carter, thanks.
Thank you very much.
My fellow Americans, we have endured a week such as no nation should live through, a time of violence and tragedy.
Over the last week here on The Takeaway, we've been looking back at the 1967 riots in Detroit and how the city has changed in the 50 years since. After a summer of civil disturbances in cities across the United States in 67, President Lyndon Johnson, with one eye on the escalating conflict in Vietnam, turned the other eye on American cities, and he sat at his desk in the Oval Office and addressed the nation.
For a few minutes tonight, I want to talk about that tragedy, and I want to talk about the deeper questions that it raises for us all. I am tonight appointing a special advisory commission on civil disorders. Governor Otto Kerner of Illinois has agreed to serve as chairman.
It became known as the Kerner Commission, and it was formed to investigate the causes of the uprisings. It became the first presidential commission to ever examine and publicly expose the disparities in black communities and make policy recommendations to alleviate them. Fred Harris was a United States senator from Oklahoma at the time. Today, he's the last surviving member of the Kerner Commission. Lyndon Johnson would eventually reject that committee's findings. But Fred Harris recalls the president's stated mission back in 1967.
President Johnson had said to us, I want you to find and speak the truth. First of all, about what happened, why did it happen, and what can we do to keep it from happening again and again. And that's exactly what we did. We started out immediately with 20 days of hearings. We heard from 44 witnesses that included people like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI. And then we went out as members of the commission to various cities in the country. We walked the mean streets of cities like Cincinnati and Milwaukee. John Lindsay and I together as a team did. And then we came back and we had 40-something days of reading every word of our report aloud and word for word approving it by a majority vote. We told the truth. What happened? Well, President Johnson, unfortunately, thought there was some planning or organization or conspiracy involved. We said, no, there was not. That the conditions in these cities were so bad, the wretched poverty and terrible racism and great hostilities between the people and the police, that almost any random spark could set off these riots. And that's what exactly had happened.
Tell me specifically a little bit about what you remember walking through these cities, through some of the urban cores that you went to, and what you saw.
In Cincinnati, for example, we met with a very militant group that didn't want to meet with us, wouldn't shake hands with us, black people. So much hostility against white people. And we saw the terrible conditions that existed there, terrible housing. Many of these people had come from criminally inferior schools in the South. They came, say, to Cincinnati or Milwaukee just about the time jobs were disappearing. They came for jobs. And globalization meant that a lot of these jobs disappeared. And also, of course, automation caused a lot of them to disappear. So things are really awful. In Milwaukee, I spent half a day, for example, sitting in a black barbershop. And I asked people that came in, where are you from originally? And they say Birmingham or Jackson, Mississippi or somewhere. And I started asking them first, did you find more discrimination in Jackson than you find in Milwaukee? And at first, people were puzzled. It turned out in Milwaukee, they didn't see any white people to speak of. There was more segregation in Milwaukee than in the places they had left in the South. So what we tried to do then was just to tell the truth about what we found. And we had first thought we could recommend some short-run solutions and then make a longer report, but we found that there were no short-run solutions, that you had to get at these terrible conditions out of which these riots had occurred.
So the report details awful social conditions, really puts a lot of the society, in a way, on trial for this segregation, both racial and economic. Martin Luther King eventually refers to the report as a physician's warning of approaching death with a prescription for life.
That's right. Secretary of Labor Willard Wirtz, I thought, had one of the best comments. He said that what the Kerner Commission has said is the same as the words of that great American philosopher Pogo, who said, "We have met the enemy and he is us."
And then, of course, you confront the political reality, and you confront a president who put you on this commission and then rejected its findings. I want to play for you LBJ once again. Here he is talking with Richard Daley, former mayor of Chicago and Democratic boss.
The Kerner Commission made a very exhaustive study and spent a couple of $1 million, but they recommended that I spend $80 million, and I've got no place to get the 80. I can't borrow it. I can't tax it. I can't get a tax bill of any kind. And they didn't discuss that. That's a detail they didn't get into.
So there's President Johnson complaining about his political realities after you've confronted him with some real social realities.
I understand the realities, and I want to say something about that. But that's really sad, because President Johnson did more in the field of civil rights and against poverty than any president before or since. But two things. One, a member of the House, a close friend of President Johnson's from Texas, got an advance copy, was leaked to him, of the Kerner Report, and he said to Johnson, we learned this directly from White House staff, he said to President Johnson, this thing is going to ruin you. It condones and encourages riots, and it doesn't have a good word to say about anything you've done for civil rights or against poverty. Well, that was false, but Johnson believed it. The other thing is, the Tet Offensive was happening in the latter part of February 1968, just about the time when we came out with our report. Here Johnson was feeling very beleaguered, terrible anti-war demonstrations, and then here comes this report of saying you've got to spend all this additional money here at home. The circumstances were such, misled, that Johnson rejected the report, but a lot of the good people supported it, and we made progress on virtually every aspect of race and poverty for about nearly a decade after the Kerner report.
And now, Senator, these 50 years later, of course, I know you spend time looking across the country. Many of the problems that are detailed in the report, despite progress, are still with us today. Where do you think we are?
We're in worse shape insofar as poverty is concerned. There are far more people, 44.1 million people who are poor, 13.5% of our population. That's compared with 12.5% back 50 years ago. Inequality of income and wealth has greatly worsened, particularly in recent times. Safety nets, housing, and so forth, all of those have been reduced. Education and training, we thought the key here is to put a lot more effort into education and in training, and all those kind of funds have been cut. I'm in the process with a friend, Dr. Alan Curtis, who is head of the Eisenhower Foundation, which I used to be the president of. We're putting together a 50th anniversary update of the Kerner Report, looking again at these problems, talking about where they are. We got to try to get the issues back on the agenda for the public.
Senator Fred Harris, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
Senator Fred Harris, senator from 1964 to 1973 from Oklahoma and a member of the Kerner Commission. Well, that's all for us today. Make sure to give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send us tweets at The Takeaway. And we want to keep hearing from you about the president's ban on transgender people in the military. So many of you have called in and tweeted us with your reactions. So keep those responses coming in. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting The Incredible Jessica James, a new romantic comedy starring Jessica Williams and Chris O'Dowd. This Netflix original film starts streaming July 28th. And Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turned cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.